2SER's Arts and Culture Show.
Don Memes says, so hot right now.
Tan caliente ahora!
Your weekly dose of arts and culture.
And all of that sort of stuff.
It's that weird thing that they're classics because they're classics because they're classics, and then they become the classics and everyone wants to do the classics because they're classics.
He's amazing.
Well, you need a lot of room for all that blood.
And he's hot as a firecracker.
You're listening to So Hot Right Now. You better not use me saying that.
Amazing babes.
On 2SER 107.3.
Good morning, morning, morning. You're here on So Hot Right Now, your weekly dose of art and culture. And boy, do we have a big show for you today. And it's pretty much going to be very film-esque. We've got not only the Latin American Film Festival chatting to us, we've got the Refugee Film Festival, as well as some Sydney Film Festival thrown in as well. So massive show today. We're also going to be talking with our resident head geek from Gaggle of Geeks, Blake Howard, and we're giving a tribute to an iconic film actor. But to kick things off, here's a tune from the amazing Snakeheads. This one's called Nighttime. And when we come back, we're going to be talking to George Schwartz, an amazing photographer, about his new exhibition.
I sleep all day to keep the daylight away. All of that gets run when I go out to play. I don't come alive till late to him. 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 I'm gonna take you dancing all night long. I'm a soul sucker. I'm here to suck your soul. I'm taking you places you've never, ever, ever been before. I don't come alive till late day. 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 Oh, they say I'm bad to the bone. But I know something that they don't know. I know something. They don't know. I know something that they don't know. I don't come alive till late day. I don't come alive till late day. I don't come alive till late day. I don't come alive till late day.
West Festival is back. Over 10 days, revel in 57 cultures across the Inner West.
Unearth diverse communities, from Club Koori to the Greek Sweets Festival, Mongolian, Peruvian, Balkan festivities and more.
Check out hip-hop competitions, films, spoken word, live music and food tours.
Festival kicks off June 16. For full program details, go to innerwest.newsouthwales.gov.au/openinnerwest.
Inner West Council, sponsors of 2SER 107.3.
You are here on It's So Hot Right Now with me, Sophie Lai. Hope you're having a cracking Saturday morning. And I'll be taking you all the way to midday with all the arts and culture. But first, we have a very special guest. Do George Schwartz, a photo retro bends the autobiographic genre to present compelling images that explore our universal experience of sex, sensuality, and death. Shot over four whole decades, Schwartz photos challenge histories of Australian photography. Joining us in the studio now is George himself. Good morning, George. How are you?
Good morning. I'm not half bad.
Not half bad. Glad to hear it. Now, you've been exhibiting your works for quite a while. So how did you initially get into photography?
Well, I started off as a painter, actually, an artistic painter. I painted Tachism, that is complete abstract, which re-imported to here and so seemed to be very interested in it. But photography, the usual thing. I met an Aussie girl in southern Spain where I was working on painting, as it was cheaper. And she wanted to go back home. They wouldn't let her go alone, so I came too. But she carried a camera for a cousin of her. And I said, look, I'm not carrying a camera for nobody, except I'm using it. So that's what we did, and I started to take photographs, not travel photographs, you know, not so on. Me in front of the Taj Mahal with the right hand up.
Yeah.
Me in front of the Eiffel Tower with the left hand up. No, photos which I would have taken anyway. And as I said before, as I was a painter, the color, the form, and the compositions for any photograph were for me very, very important. Not like a journalistic photographer who has to have an action for something. I just had to see it from an artistic point of view. That's how I see my whole life. Then art is my life.
Yeah.
Including my religion, even.
How was the transition from painting to photography in that way? Because there is so many more factors with light and, you know, composition, as you mentioned.
Well, it was different, I have to admit. But I obviously took to it like a fish to water. There was no complication. And later on, when digital started, I took to them too. I had the help of a student of mine as I was lecturing in art. And she helped me into digital. As when I was teaching, I only taught photography. And this happened for the sheer fact that some lecturer said to me, do you have any idea about photography? I said, yeah, why? Look, the department is yours. So thank you much. What happened? Look, I'm sick of reading tonight what I'm lecturing tomorrow. So photography became really my life. I read everything to the point where I could honestly say anything I don't know is hardly worthwhile knowing. I had all these encyclopedias in my mind. I could tell you every developer, what's made of, how many percentage, what changes and so on. That was the technical side. I think I'm very good at that. But the artistic side was always my thing. I always voted, and I got practically almost immediately into photo montage. First I cut out. This was, you printed it.
Yep.
And then you cut it out, not with a pair of scissors, of course, very, very carefully.
Yeah.
Undercutting with a scalpel.
Yep.
Then splitting the back of the paper off, sending it on the edge and colour the edges in case and stick it down.
Wow.
I don't think anybody else here is as good as I am in that. I know I blow my own trumpet, but you have to.
Of course.
So, and as soon as digital appeared, I asked a student of mine who had studied it if she knew anybody that she could teach me. And she said, I can do it. I said, come on, Linda. You are just too well known in the industry. I couldn't afford you.
Aww.
So we made out. Yes, she comes once a week under one condition. I feed her.
Oh, what a brilliant. That's brilliant.
She said, I have a certain requirements for my food. I said, well, give them to me and that's it. And she was a student of mine once. And then she became basic my lecturer.
Amazing.
Now she's my friend.
Excellent. That's amazing. Throughout your you're in this exhibition, you're exhibiting over 40 years worth of photography. How has your style changed artistically through those years?
Well, basically, the philosophy has changed very little.
Mm-hmm.
Picture taking has changed. As on the beginning, in Sydney here, I was shocked. I had to photograph Sith and that and other things, which I just couldn't believe. I was also at the same time into movie making, which we made quite a few movies, which are now at the Film and Sound Archive, as I couldn't believe how you people lived here. No, I'm one of them. I can prove that.
Yeah.
For the fact, if you have something against Australia,
mm-hmm.
I'm going to defend it like hell.
Wow.
But I have the right to have something against it, as I'm Aussie.
Yeah. Very, very true. Mm. So the major things that you explore in Photo Retro, it's a lot about our common human experiences like sex, death, and unconscious. Why did you kind of explore this one in this particular exhibition?
Well, I must admit, sex is a great interest for me. Always was.
For a lot of people, I'm sure.
I know, and I liked the female form.
Mm-hmm.
Dressed or naked, I photographed a lot. I also have been drawing a lot of females, as I was teaching drawing too.
Mm-hmm.
And we had some models. So I started to get some models dressed up and put them into different things that it was very boring for students just having a model falling asleep. So we got very known and happened, and I went on. This was always an interest in my life, as I'm very aware of it.
Mm.
All my family had the glorious idea to die when I was very early.
Mm-hmm.
Grandmothers came to our house, and she died there too. So for me, this was normal. As in Switzerland, I played in the backyard of the slaughterhouse.
Wow.
Yeah, I learned to play marbles with cow's eyes.
Holy smokes.
So this was normal.
Yeah.
And for a lot of people here in Australia too, you know how many are around who say, had 9, raised 5?
Really?
Oh, yeah. You see, I'm born before penicillin.
Mm.
And before biros,
mm-hmm.
and lighters, all that stuff.
Yeah.
That wasn't known.
Yeah.
So the coming and going and passage of time is important for me. A part of that, some people accuse me that I'm a dreamer, which is probably true. I like dreaming. I can walk down Broadway here and see weird things. Like, let's say an elephant coming out of the restaurant across the road, perfectly dressed up with all things. And I know it's not true.
Yeah.
I'm not mad.
No.
But fantasies like that running in my brain all the time.
Mm.
So I develop and love it. And that's basically it. Now, for this show is over 40 years. So I had about over 20 or 25 exhibitions in this time.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't take everything from everyone. We had to, a friend of mine, Craig Judd, he worked with me to organize this. We chosen what we were think would go together or would work. We still haven't figured out how we're going to hang it. If we're going to hang it chronologically or impact-wise. I prefer impact-wise, quite honestly.
Yeah.
You see, my pictures are, I can that very shortly. When you see a picture of mine, I want you to get an impression, a feeling. I'm don't giving it a title. Without a title gives me immediately an impression to you. No, I want the picture to do that, like music.
Mm.
And you can listen to the same music several times, and it always gives a different impression. It involves with what happened outside, how you feel.
Mm.
So, and there are so many impressions of which we don't even have words.
Yeah.
Like, for example, the Eskimos have 11 words for snow.
11?
Yeah. You say, know what it is? We don't. So, said I'd also, in emotions, it's the same. There are so many around, which I can't tell you.
Mm.
Let's, for argument's sake, say, it's the first time you kissed. You remember that?
I do.
Yes, I knew you do. That is an impression which is only yours.
Yeah.
Not mine. Nobody else. That's what I want. It's a precious thing to you. And when you see a work of mine, it should give you a similar impression, or maybe changes next year or next week and so on. So you work with the picture. And the picture works with you.
I get that.
Good.
I get that.
I expect something. Sam, you here working here on the radio, you do know it is an insult to a composer to play music in the background whilst you eat and chat.
Of course.
Yeah. You know, we have music for that.
Mm-hmm.
But with music, I want it to be quiet. I don't want an alarm ringing. I take the phone off the hook and listen to it. So I get an impression. I say many times it's changing.
Yeah.
So that's what my pictures are supposed to do. Yeah, the colors are not what we say brilliant. They are subtle, like it today. As I come from the painting, I still have that feeling. You know, in a painting, you wouldn't make a red absolutely brilliant and give it a feeling. And so, what's surrounding it? So that's what I'm doing. As I say, art is my life. Photography is now my way of doing it. Yes, I started color photography very early.
Yeah,
I introduced it at the National Art School, which refused it and called it its only snapshots. So I spoke to my students.
Yeah.
The next week, I had some money on the table from them.
Oh,
as they wanted it.
That's amazing.
So that's how it started, color photography here in National Art School. And so I said, color is important for me, very, very much. I probably can't remember more than two melodies. Like God Saves the Queen, and the other one I've forgotten, music-wise. But visual, I can tell anybody what jumpers they wore at a certain time.
Mm. Amazing.
It's just for me. Color is my life.
I understand that. Well, George, thank you so much for chatting to us. Can't wait to see what impressions your images give us when we finally see it, when it opens. But thank you so much for joining us here today on 2SER.
Well, thank you very much for listening to it. And be aware there are pictures of all kinds of things. Some might be shocking. I don't think so, as that's also part of life.
Very true, but thank you again.
Thank you.
That there was George Schwartz talking all about his upcoming exhibition, Photo Retro, showing at Black Eye Gallery. The show opened on the 22nd and is showing until July 2nd. There's official opening party night then, 6 to 8 at the gallery on Thursday. So head on down, meet George, have a few drinks and see what impressions his images will give you. You're listening to So Hot Right Now with me, Sophie. Just after this short tune, we're going to be hearing from Blake Howard, our resident geek. But for now, here's Euclisine with Bound Bright Foray.
Thank you.
That there was Yugoslene with Bound Bright Foray. You're here on So Hot right now with me, Sophie Lai. Now it's time for...
To the Batmobile. Let's go.
Atomic batteries to power. Turbines to speed.
Roger. Ready to move out.
Holy smokes, Batman. It's Gaggle of Geeks with...
Blake Howard.
And Sophie Lai.
Oh, Blake Howard. Oh, graffiti with punctuation. Never has our theme been more poignant.
I know. This week, so the geek world was shaken. We've gone from losing a James Bond with Roger Moore to losing my original Batman. I don't know if folks listening who your first Batman is, because that will kind of define your era. Sometimes it's Keaton, but Adam West, the legendary Adam West from the original Batman 66 TV show and movie of the same name, has passed away this week. And apart from being just purely devastated across the boards that he's now passed away, it's just been the outpouring of some of the most beautiful tributes to him in his whole life, and it's been a pretty incredible week. So if you didn't know who Adam West was, he was an actor. Really, his most absolutely famous role was Batman, and playing Mayor West on Family Guy, for many of us, a reminder of how amazing his comedic talents were. And Batman 66 for a long time was the campy and abandoned. That was the Batman that no one wanted to talk about. I think if you go back, even those Batman tragics who absolutely adore things like the Chris Nolan Batman series or Michael Keaton, there is something that is undeniable about Adam West Batman, in that everyone else knew that the show was a campy, weird, take on the Caped Crusader, and ridiculous take, ultimately. Mm-hmm. And it was meant to be a farce. But I think the thing that makes the show still so powerful and so hilarious is that he plays Batman so sincerely that it's impossible not to, be engaged by him, He's just sensational. And so... this week was kind of a sad week, but also an awesome week to see the tributes. And particularly, I think about 24 hours ago in Los Angeles, they shone the bat signal on Los Angeles City Hall, and 12,000 people turned out to watch it light up there to tribute him as a tribute. And the original Batmobile was there.
What?
And it's just been a crazy, outpouring of love in Los Angeles and Bat fans all around the world, just, reminiscing about what an impact Adam West had on their lives as youngsters, and how he played an amazing and overwhelmingly awesome Batman.
Yeah, when people say, oh, who's Adam West? And you're like, the Batman guy. And they're like, who? And he's like, the ones that had kapow and bang, instead of having the actual noise, they would just have it as a super on the screen. People are like, oh, yeah. And then all you have to say is shark repellent Batman. They're like, oh, my God. Even if they've never seen it, they know of his Batman because it's so iconic.
Yeah, it's the original, it's the first one that was really powerful on TV. There had been another original sort of Batman TV show a long time ago, similar to an old Superman show that had been out with George Reeves. There was a Batman equivalent, and there were old movies, but they just didn't have, this was color television, and this was sort of a Batman, comic smackdown on TV and done in prime time, and it was extremely successful and ran for three seasons, but it just ran forever. So it went from 66-ish to about 1969. Mm. But he, that ran until the early 90s, at least on television in a lot of stations, because I remember it myself growing up with it. It's a crazy show that just had constant replay value, and in a world that was kind of pre-Wiggles, it was had enough bam and kapow and bright colors that you could hypnotize your children with it. And I think for better or worse, I was definitely hypnotized with it as a kid.
And it was wholesome fun. You probably are a bit iffy about showing your kids Batman now, because you're like, oh, that's a bit dark. But this was just beautiful campness.
Yeah.
Watching it again this week, I was like, oh, this is so funny. Like, comedic timing is just deadpan.
Dry. It's wonderful. Like, and you watch Adam West, and a lot of the clips are like, oh, Robin, that's what happens when we mess with the laws of nature. Like, he's so amazing, like, great delivery. And then you've got all these wonderful people that are around him, like Cesar Romero, who mm-hmm. wouldn't shave his moustache to be the Joker. You had three different Catwomans, including Eartha Kitt, like an African-American Catwoman. Mm-hmm. Burgess Meredith as the Penguin, you know, the guy who ended up playing Mickey in Rocky series. You know, you had Frank Gorshin playing the Riddler. You had these great, iconic characters. And I think it's really only now that you see that people are going back and reappraising it and putting it in context and going, you know what, this is actually kind of a masterpiece of comedy and of Batman. Mm. You know, you see that Batman 66 comics. And look, one of the, you know, for the geek world, I'm sure you love Kevin Smith and you would possibly listen to some of his podcasts. But Ralph Garman, who is his co-host on a podcast called Hollywood Babylon and probably one of the biggest Batman fans of all time, was ahead of the campaign to get Adam West a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. And in fact, myself and also our former, your former co-host here at Gaggle of Geeks, Maria Lewis, who's at Supernova this weekend, donated money because it cost $25,000 to get $25,000 American to get a star on the Walk of Fame. And, you know, it was a travesty that he hadn't been honored there. And in the last couple of years, he's definitely turned that around. So he's now got a star on the Walk of Fame that he deserves. And even as recently as 2016, the Batman Return of the Caped Crusaders, where he voiced Batman in a new cartoon. And there's even an unreleased version of Batman where he was Batman versus Two-Face, another cartoon in the Batman 66 style, which we haven't seen yet. So,
yeah.
You know, he's Batman forever for us. His legacy will be Batman and even Batman beyond his passing in some voiceover work. And for all those Family Guy friends, Family Guy fans out there, you will see him on reruns forever as Mayor West. And, you know, his memory will live on forever and ever. And as it deservedly should. The greatest Batman of all time in my mind.
So, so true. Well, Blake, thank you for that beautiful tribute to Adam West. We'll leave it here with a bit of wise words from Commissioner Gordon and Batman. See you next week.
Thanks, Sof.
Are you going to try him in court?
I haven't decided yet, Batman. With your approval, I'd like to think it over. No, no choice is easy in a case like this.
I agree completely, Commissioner. The law of this city is in your hands. We just try to help a bit. Here and there, wherever we can.
So brave, so dependable, and so modest. Rare in men these days. Very rare.
Sydney Film Festival is on right now and must finish on Sunday, June 18. Hurry to sff.org.au to choose from hundreds of films on offer at 12 venues across the city, from the beautiful State Theatre to the Ritz Cinema in Randwick. Dramas, documentaries, comedy, horror, music, you name it, you'll be spoilt for choice. Book online or call 1300 733 733. Sydney Film Festival, sponsors of 2SER.
You're listening to SER 107.3 with me, Sophie Lai, and the Passion Mama Festival, which happens as part of the Latin American Film Festival, is coming this week and brings you live music, film screenings, a yarn circle, spoken word workshops, and a virtual reality film experience like no other. We're joined on the line by Mark Taylor, who co-founded the Sydney Latin American Film Festival. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, Sophie. How are you doing?
Very, very well. How are you?
Good, good. Sorry, the plane flying over. Might be a bit.
Perks of living in the inner city, hey?
I know. How are you?
I am well. Now, the Passion Mama Festival, it's a bit of a mini festival from the Latin American Film Festival. Can you tell us more about it?
Yeah, definitely. Well, the Passion Mama Festival is in its fourth year, and it's one of our lead-up events to the main Sydney Latin American Film Festival. It came about because we were getting a lot of content from Latin America around indigenous stories from different parts of Latin America, and we wanted to be able to kind of group them together, and then also just it's a chance for us to engage with local artists in Sydney as well. So it's more than just the film. So if we engage musicians and artists, dancers, so it's kind of a blank canvas each year, and then we put it out there and people kind of get involved with it as we go along. So
so you're kind of combining Latin American indigenous arts as well as indigenous artists from here. What was the benefit of bringing these two cultures together in this way?
There are a number of opportunities for different artists to come together, and we just found that this was a really good platform for people from Latin America to kind of connect up with local indigenous communities through the arts, and it's a platform, I guess. The festival is a chance for them to work together, and it's working really well. So there's not that many opportunities for people from overseas to really connect with Australian Indigenous communities. So that's kind of one of the reasons why we set up Pachamama Festival.
Yeah. How have some of the communities from Latin America kind of reacted to seeing the Indigenous stories over here? And was it anything what they expected?
For a lot of the artists, our feedback is that it's been a really good opportunity to connect and work with local Indigenous artists. Whether it's through music or, shared storytelling or even spoken word. So, I think the feedback is that it's a really good opportunity, and they get a lot from it as well. Just there's a lot of shared stories. The filmmaker who's coming across, who's bringing the virtual reality actually through his own kind of connections, is working with Indigenous groups in the Amazon. So he's been back and forth to work with media producers in the Amazon who work in specifically in community media. So it's kind of really nice to see that there are these kind of cross-cultural opportunities that exist out there.
Yeah. And you're showcasing a Mexican film at Pachamama, Mara Acame's Dream. Can you tell us more about the film?
Yeah, the film is it's a Huichol story. So it's the filmmakers from Mexico, and it's a story about a young man who is where it kind of delves into the role of culture in today's society, for particularly for young Indigenous men and women growing up. And so it's the story of what his family would like him to follow, and then what he kind of gets caught up, through pop culture and in Mexico society today. And it's a beautiful film, and it's actually the film we're going to launch the launch of the cinema with. So it kind of has a double it's a very special session, that one on Saturday. Yeah.
Excellent. And looking ahead to the film festival in September, how are you going there? How's the schedule looking? Got any picks yet?
Yeah, all locked off. Our festival program is locked off for September. So we'll be back down at the Dandy Cinemas in Opera Keys. A bit of a difference to the programming this year is over 50% of the film directors are women filmmakers from Latin America. So the programmers this year really wanted to focus on that and to see, to shine a spotlight on what female directors are doing in Latin America.
Amazing.
Yeah.
And can you also talk about a bit more about the grassroots community projects that the Latin American Film Festival is involved in?
Sure. Every year, well, since we've started, we're set up as a volunteer organisation, and after costs, we do a sort of, I guess, a grant system where grassroots organisations from across Latin America can access funds that are raised through the festival. So each year we choose we try and sort of, I mean, Latin America is a broad, a big place. So we each year we kind of focus on different issues and different geographic locations. And it's also, it's a way to raise much needed funds because dollars raised here go a long way in some of these communities.
Mm.
And also allows a bit of awareness around the some of the work that's being done in Latin America and some of the issues that communities are facing. So, yeah, and it really is the driving force behind the festival. You know, the core idea of the festival was that we could bring stories from Latin America, which are rich and which, you know, enrich our lives by watching them.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, we're able to give back to the communities where the stories come from in a way that's sustainable as possible, you know, which has been, has its challenges. It's, you know, increasingly expensive to put on a film festival with screening fees and theatre costs, but we still manage to, I mean, we've got a really good community in Sydney that support us, and the fundraising aspect to the festival is still quite strong.
Excellent. See some great films, also support some communities overseas.
Yeah, totally.
Great. But Mark, thank you so much for chatting to us today.
That's okay.
About the Pasha Mama Festival. We'll catch you then. It happens this Friday.
Yeah, there is a, easy way to get to Pasha Mama Festival is pashamamafestival.com, which has the full program and including opening night, which is a free event with some incredible Latin American and Australian artists coming together to perform spoken word and music.
Brilliant. Can't wait to see what happens.
Okay.
But Mark, thanks, Mark.
Bye.
As mentioned, the Pashamama Festival is happening next weekend on Friday, the 23rd of June to the 24th. It's happening at Addison Road Community Centre in Marrickville. We'll pop all those details up on our show page. Just head to 2SER.com/hot right now. The Latin American Film Festival, though, if you're still interested, also kicks off later in the year from September 8th to 12th, and we'll put some details up on that as well. We're going to jump to a tune from Tuxedo. This one's called Lost Lover, and we come back a bit more film festival with the Sydney Film Festival.
Don't you know that I
Lost Lover there by Tuxedo in what my producer would call tune. You're here on So Hot right now, your weekly dose of arts and culture with me, Sophie Lai. By the Time It Gets Dark is a new Thai film screening at the Sydney Film Festival. It begins with a young film director interviewing an older woman about a massacre of university students 40 years prior and shifts across multiple perspectives to create an abstract portrait of contemporary Thailand. It's a film for those seeking uncompromising and unique filmmaking. 2SER's Chris Evans sat down with writer-director Anosha Suresha Akonpong to talk about the difficulties of creating such a challenging film.
What's your creative process like? Do images come first for you and then find their meaning linked together? Or do you start with a concept and then have images born from that?
It varies, actually, but usually it's the image that pops into my head or sometimes I see in real life and then it sticks in my mind. Usually it's not so related to what then the film will become later on, but it gives me a starting point. Actually, in the case of By the Time It Gets Dark, there was an image that was a starting point and I wrote it in the script and then we shot it, but then I decided to take it out.
What actually was that image?
It's of a 6-lane motorway, so like 3 on each side with the traffic coming and going, but seen through like the fence wire from the bridge.
Did you have a lot of difficulty putting the funding together to make this film? Because it's such a challenging film.
It was really difficult. It's my second feature. So after I made my first feature, I actually thought it was going to be easier to raise funding for the second film. It turned out to be the opposite. Mm-hmm. But also maybe it was related to, you know, how the subject matter partly being about the massacre. So it took me like 6 years altogether to make this film. And the funding just... You know, I actually had to shot part of the film first and then try to raise more money. And that all came together, I think, just the last year of the production. Then once we had all the money in place, then we finished the shoot.
Do you think that By the Time It Gets Dark is a political film? Or is it a film about the impossibility of making a political film?
I think it is a political film. You know the French film Nocturama by Bertrand Bonello? I think he said something quite recently about his film being a political film and not an activist film. There's a marked difference between the two, and I would like to think the same way about my film.
When people watch your films, would you like people to take away a set fixed meaning that you had in mind, or are you happy for people to have their own experience where they take away something subjective?
The latter, of course. Yeah. I think I don't want the film to be didactic. I mean, actually, it's quite obvious it's not. You know, and I don't want it to be preachy. I'm not like that myself. Sometimes, actually, it's much more interesting that people have their own reading of the film. It's about to happen. It's being seen by people from different cultures, different parts of the world. And I think it's nice that way that people have their own interpretation, their own way to access the film.
A lot of people talk about cinema as capturing the truth. There's that famous quote about it being truth at 24 frames a second. But by the time it gets dark, it seems to capture artificiality a lot of the time. What do you think the purpose of the camera is? Does it really see the truth, or is it something that's used to feed lies to us?
I think there's a very fine line between truth and lies. Of course, you know, by the time it gets dark, it's like layer upon layer of lies or artificiality. But I think the film deals with lies, but it's not about lies. Essentially, I think it is about truth. How do we get to the truth? But before we get to the truth, we have to go through all these layers of lies first. I don't know if I have the final answer, do we get there or not? But the film is an attempt to find truth.
The style of the film, especially in the early sections, it reminded me a lot of You probably get this a lot. We're ascetical.
Yeah.
Is there something culturally in the air in Thailand that gives rise to that? Is it Buddhism?
Okay. No, I get it a lot, but actually I don't mind the question. He's a great filmmaker, so being compared to him is not a bad thing, right? I don't know if it's Buddhism or like the landscape. My cinematographer and I, we are very good friends. We went to film school together and he shot almost all my films since film school. He's from Hong Kong. So when we do prep work, we don't watch Apichat Pong's films, actually. But I'm a big fan. I think it's quite hard to pin down what it is. I can't analyze this myself.
What were some of the things you spoke about with your cinematographer?
Because we have worked together over the years. Now, it's quite easy to communicate with him. In the case of By the Time It Gets Dark, the architecture of the house really dictated a lot of the style of shooting, the landscape around that house also. It was shot in a place called Nan, which is a province about 5 hours from Chiang Mai. The house itself there's so many windows and glass. It called for a certain kind of shots. But we didn't really watch any films together. I never had any moment where I saw something and I said to him, oh, let's do it this way. It was just walk through the places together and then he would start. This was in pre-production. And he would show me some shots and I would then have some input if I liked it or not and if there was any adjustments to be made. And I think I'm lucky, you know, because we have worked together for many years. So it went quite easy.
Did the director character in this film come from your own thoughts about writing a political film? Or was that born just of a piece with the rest of the film?
Yes and no. I started the film, like writing in terms of the script. It was based on actually just one character. In the beginning, it was of the woman who keeps changing jobs. She was the first character that I developed. At one point, the whole film was about her. Over the course of writing, you know, I started to reassess my relationship to the project. And I felt that I wanted to offer more of myself in the film and to really be part of it. So I started to create this character of a woman director. But then again, I wouldn't say she's completely based on me because I ended up casting someone who's actually a real life filmmaker. She's a director herself and she's a good friend of mine. So I ended up using things from her life too. But yeah, in a way, it had to do with the impossibility of making a film about a massacre.
That was Anocha Suricha Kongpong, director of By the Time It Gets Dark, a new Thai film that pushes the boundaries of narrative cinema. She was speaking to 2SER's Chris Evans. By the Time It Gets Dark is screened today at the Sydney Film Festival. You can check sff.com.au for details. You can also hear an extended version of this interview on the Celluloid Dreams page at 2SER.com. You're here on So Hot Right Now with me, Sophie.
Oh yeah! 2SER 1073.
One of, if not the most important issue of our time is the refugee crisis, and what better way to explore this further than through art. This week marks the 2017 Refugee Week and consequently the inaugural Refugee Film Festival. This morning we are joined on the line by Tim O'Connor to tell you more about the event. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning, Sophie.
How are you?
Well, very excited to be down here at New South Wales State Library. The Refugee Film Festival has kicked off with our first film. We had a great crowd in this morning and we've got a couple of sellouts, but we've still got a few seats left if people are interested in coming down and learning a bit more about the human side of the crisis that so often gets lost in the public debate that we have in this country.
Brilliant. I mean, this is the first time that a film festival has been set up as part of Refugee Week. Can you tell us more about how we kind of came together?
Well, basically for the last few years we've been working with different filmmakers to get community screenings happening around the country, and we thought, why not bring this together into a film festival? So it's happening in Sydney this weekend, today and tomorrow at the New South Wales State Library. It's also rolling out in Melbourne too throughout the entirety of Refugee Week, which runs from today until next Sunday.
Amazing. Now, there's a great range of films showing. Can you tell us a bit more about them?
Yeah, absolutely. What we've tried to do with the festival is really have a broader look at the refugee experience because, as you say, you know, there is a crisis of human displacement at the moment. We have 65 million people in the world who are displaced, 21 million of them recognised as refugees, but we focus very much here on the people coming to be resettled in Australia. And internationally, of those 21 million refugees, last year only 107,000 were permanently resettled.
Wow.
So there's a huge gap. And really, it's an opportunity to have a broader look at the issue of human displacement. And we're really focusing on those human stories. Well, the key fun premiere film this afternoon is The Staging Post. I think there's only one or two tickets left for that. But it really documents the story of, you know, the so-called success, as our government likes to talk about, of stopping the boats. But what happened to the people who were pushed back? So it's a film set in Indonesia in a place called Chisarua, and really looks at the incredible initiative and agency of refugees and how they've managed to survive in Indonesia, who isn't a signatory of the Refugee Convention, and therefore people who are refugees there don't have the opportunity to work or to send their kids to school or get access to healthcare. So it's really a fantastic insight into how those communities have, you know, used their own resources and managed to survive.
Yeah, I mean, like offshore detention, it's a huge issue, especially with the whole Manus Island ruling this week. Do any of the films touch up on that?
Yeah, we've got a film, a number of the films do, In Procedure and Life is Waiting, which are happening tomorrow. In Procedure's on at 10:30, and also Life is Waiting, which is 12:30, which is about people who were stuck in that limbo, which is so typical of the refugee experience. But, you know, there's a real duality in Australia as well. You know, the public debate, if you can call it that, is very focused on kind of the toxic, brutal nature in which Australia treats people who seek asylum, who come here by boat.
Mm.
But the other side of it is that Australia is probably the best country in the world when it comes to resettling refugees. We have a very long history of doing that. We've got fantastic organisations that do it. You know, there is a broad support in the community for welcoming refugees. And it's really trying to tell that whole story, not just focus on the toxic debate that we know so well, but really is taking us nowhere. Because ultimately, Australia's current policy, as is proved with Manus decision this week, where $70 million was paid out to people who were on Manus, is that the government, you know, has folded. It's waved the white flag. It doesn't want an independent investigation into what is happening on our offshore detention centres, because they know it's cruel. I mean, Amnesty's called it torture.
Mm.
And ultimately, it's an unsustainable policy. It damages our international reputation, costs Australian taxpayers billions of dollars, literally. The immigration minister this week said it's been $13.7 billion we'd spent on locking, you know, a few thousand people up offshore. That's twice the money the UNHCR spends internationally each year on looking after 21 million refugees. So it's totally crazy.
But ultimately,
the worst bit of it is it's really doing untold damage to innocent people's lives.
Absolutely. Now, one of the other films that you have is called Constance on the Edge, which is more about a family's resettlement story in Australia. And it's shot over 10 years. That's incredible. Can you tell a bit more about that?
Yeah, it is an amazing... Constance is an amazing story about an amazing woman. So the filmmakers, Belinda Mason, who is speaking tomorrow at the Q&A, went over to Kenya. She met up with Constance in the refugee camp there, and then, documented the story of her life and how she'd lost her husband and was bringing up these children in very difficult circumstances.
Mm.
And then Constance Wells resettled to Australia and is one of those people which was, you know, really won the lottery in being able to successfully come here. She set up in Wagga with a, brood of children ranging from, toddlers right through to teenagers. And it really documents the successes and challenges that she'd faced. And really just shows the incredible resilience that Constance and so many refugees have, and also the welcome that is offered by so many Australians too. So it's a fantastic, heartening story about the refugee experience, again, that we don't often hear about because the debate in this country is so incredibly toxic.
Yeah, that said, though, we do need to have that conversation about the toxic conditions so we can hear more about, these stories of resettlement, do we not? Just because if we can get them off these detention centres...
Yeah, well, absolutely. Offshore detention is, part of the problem. It's a crazy policy. Australia's, one of the few countries in the world, the only country in the world that does anything as brutal as that. I mean, locking up kids in immigration detention, horrendous.
Mm.
We've seen, we've got a royal commission going on to institutional child sexual abuse at the moment, but it's not looking at the 37 cases of child sexual abuse that have been alleged on Nauru.
Mm.
These are centres that are funded, by the Australian government. Most of the staff working in the centres are Australian, certainly managing the centres. We have some real culpability there, and we need to understand what is happening. But also there is another side to the refugee experience, and it's really understanding how we can ensure that people can flee persecution, can flee conflict, and live with dignity in the country that they arrive in. So that's why it's such a huge disgrace that Australia's cut its aid program so much, because, for instance, with the 65,000 Rohingya who fled out of Burma into Bangladesh in the last couple of months, they're living in makeshift camps. They have no access to clean water, limited access to food. They can't send their kids to school. They can't get access to healthcare. They can't legally work. They're in an incredibly difficult situation. And what Australia should be doing, if we really wanted to stop the boats, was be supporting those people when they flee to be able to live with dignity.
Absolutely. It is happening this weekend. What are you hoping people are going to take away from watching any of the films that are screening?
Well, what we're hoping to take away is that, our government and the public debate is so much about dehumanising asylum seekers and dehumanising refugees. But, 21 million refugees is a large number, but each one of those is a person. They have a mother, a father, they've got family members, they're people that love them. They're humans. They're people, just like you and me. And that's really the thing to take away, is behind those 21 million statistic numbers, there's 21 million stories, and each of those stories is unique and amazing. And we've got the opportunity over the next couple of days, and so people in Sydney, to come down and understand those individual stories behind the statistics and really understand the humanity and the challenges that refugees face.
Well, we can't wait to see some of those films that are happening right now. But Tim, thank you so much for joining us here on It's So Hot Right Now.
No worries. Thanks so much, Sophie.
Not a problem. That was Tim O'Connor, who works at the Refugee Film Festival. It is happening today and tomorrow only at the State Library on Macquarie Street. There's a huge range of great films to check out. So we'll pop up the program online and put all the details on 2ser.com. As you mentioned, only a few tickets left, so get in quick. Well, my time here is just about up. Thanks for joining me here on It's So Hot Right Now. I'll catch you next week for more arts and culture. But to leave you, here's a tune from Palms. They were playing last night at the Lansdowne, which has reopened. Yes, with a small venue back and running. And can I say, it is awesome. This one's called Beatdown. I'll catch you next week. Bye. Here comes a beatdown.